You put it in your mouth. The tongue with the taste buds, the moisture there and everything, make it possible for you to taste that food. And a good taster can tell the cook everything she put in that food. That's an intelligent mouth, isn't it? Say, hey, I tell you what you put in this. They say, what is this? Say, I tell you what you put in this. Say, you put some black pepper in here and some salt, and you put a little anise in here, and I think you got some parsley in here, and you put a little turmeric too in there. Hey, how do you know that? So I got sharp taste, right? So the mouth is very intelligent. It can taste and tell what's there, what's in the food that it has taken. But once it gets past the mouth, tongue part, it goes into the neck. The neck ain't tasting anything. The neck ain't tasting anything. Now, the neck, its main role is to drop it down to the visceral section. So the neck passes right on down into the visceral body. And the visceral body can't taste anything either. But the visceral body acts on impulse. And the first thing you know, you're throwing up. Ah, dog, I shouldn't have eaten that. That stuff must have been spoiled. Now, it can have bad stuff in it, but if it's terrible, if it's too terrible, only when it's too terrible will the inner throw it back. They don't want that. Now you can put too much sugar down there, you ain't gonna throw up. Eat too much salt, you ain't gonna throw up. Get sugar diabetes, get the dropsy, get a whole lot of diseases. The stomach never threw it up, say, hey, don't do that. But the tongue says, hey, that's too salty. The tongue says, hey, that's too sweet. Right? Yeah, so the tongue got more intelligence than this visceral section, right? All right. So we find that as we go up toward the head, the senses are a little better. Now, you know, once I ate something that hurt my feet, now when the feet feel it, I'm telling you, that was really bad. We have to look at these developments and understand that these developments are not us. It didn't just start either. Do you know the Bible have a character in it? He's called Belial. And the man that our prophet chose to be a caller to worship for him is Belial. And I'm convinced from my studies of scripture and the history that Belial is the same name as Belial in the Bible. And Belial in the Bible is called a worthless thing. You can look up the name in a good English dictionary, and a good English dictionary will tell you Belial means a worthless thing. Now you may say, mister, are you saying that black people are worthless? Well, you know, when you're lazy, you'll be called worthless. I can't say black people are worthless because you've been working like the dog for the white man for better than four centuries. So I can't call you lazy. You just have a visceral attitude toward work. And we hope we'll work this out. Now, what I meant when I said that this is not us is this. Slavery totally separated us from us. Slavery left us somewhere in the past and made of us a new creature. This is what we have to understand. Now, I know there is that rare exception where a sojourner truth or somebody else survived it, came out. But how many sojourner truths do we have? How many Frederick Douglass do we have? How many Nat Turners have we had? Not that I'm approving his action. I think he was acting too from a visceral impulse. Nat Turner. The circumstances there didn't make it sensible for that man to do what he did. So he was doing what Don Elijah Muhammad did, say, I'm going to make a great ripple on the ocean before I die. Maybe Nat Turner was saying the same thing. I'm going to make a great ripple on the ocean before I die. I don't know. But I know for one thing, what he did wasn't practical. What he did wasn't intelligent, wasn't sensible. Not in the way of achieving the objective. If the objective was to liberate those people, then what he did was foolhardy. And those who have read the story of Nat Turner, you will agree. Not only that, what John Brown did, he was a white man. What John Brown did was foolhardy. And they picked John Brown as a John the Baptist. A John the Baptist who is so stirred up in emotions that he can't think straight. And they picture him as a wild man. If you've seen some of the artist drawings of John Brown, they draw him as a wild man. His eyes are wild. His hair's wild. They draw him as a wild man, saying that this man was driven mad by the desire to free black people. Am I on the right road? Now, let me know. Give me some indication. You know, I'm very sensitive. I usually can feel you. But today, something is different here. I don't feel you today. All right. So let me know if I'm on the wrong direction. If I'm on the wrong road, I'll stop and talk to you. In looking back, we have to consider how Africa has influenced our lives today. Now, Africa is a place where Bilal was born. And the Arabs called Bilal not an Ethiopian, they called him Habashi. Habashi. Habashi is Ethiopia. Ethiopia and Habashi the same. It's only these different names. I don't know why the Arabs don't call him an Ethiopian, but they don't. They choose to call him Habashi. I think the name Ethiopia is a good name. I don't find nothing bad with Ethiopia. They say Ethiopia means black. But I'm going to do some more traveling with you in just a minute on Ethiopia. You know, the map, the old map of Africa, used to have the name Ethiopia across it. The whole thing was Ethiopia. And later, it had other names on it. And something happened during the colonial period. The white man's name put on it. And the term Africa is not the black man's choosing. The term Africa is the white man's choosing. Now, what I advocate is a compromise with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. What I mean by compromise, a compromise is when you want something and I want something, and I can't accept all of what you want, and you can't accept all of what I want. So that's a compromise, right? There's many other ways to describe a compromise, but that's a compromise. So those minds who are of the mind of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad of the old days, I can't buy everything that they want. I can't accept everything that they want. But I'm ready to make a compromise. What is this compromise? I want, insist upon everything that I want. Now, if I get everything that I want, it's not practical. It's not intelligent on my part for me to do that. You have to go back to the past. Don't you know the future brings along the past? The present brings up the past? It has to, not because it likes it, but because it's needed. So we want a compromise. And we're asking that we look back to Africa, because the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he talked black. He insisted upon black man, black identity, identity with black people. And he insisted upon this too, that the black man will rule. That the time of the white man is out. He insisted upon that. And I think that was a very good psychology. A very good psychology. Why? Because most of us thought that the white man was in and would never go out. And most of us couldn't even make any progress because we say, oh, why make the effort? The white man ain't gonna let us do it. Why try? The white man won't let us succeed. So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, the white man's time is out. So you know, those who accepted that, they say, well, hell, if his time is out, maybe I can get started. And you know, I'm just beginning to understand what he said. I agree with him, the white man's time is out. Because the white man is a man that was born with white supremacy. And white supremacy is out. I'm sure most of you can understand what I said and agree with me. That the white man is a man that was born with white supremacy. If you study the history of the people of Earth, they weren't calling themselves white people until white supremacy was conceived. They were calling themselves Irish, Italian, English. They were calling themselves by many names, but they were not calling themselves white people. In fact, when you go among them now, they don't refer to themselves as white people. They refer to themselves by their ethnic names. But when they address a black and white world, they refer to themselves as white people. We have made the mistake of buying their terminology, of going along with their terminology, of picking up blindly their language. It's okay to use the term black if you know how to place that language. But if you don't know how to place that language, and if you think black is your identity, then you have been misled, you have been misguided, you have been tripped up by the white supremacists. Black is no identity. The white man is white, but white ain't no identity. You can't identify a white man by saying he's white. You identify a white man by saying he's Irish, by saying he's Italian. You identify a white man by his ethnicity. His ethnicity identifies him. The history of his people, as his people have evolved into society. And if you're going to identify blacks, you can't identify them as blacks. Blacks is nothing but the period of history that represents the racist domain. So how can I call myself black?
Well, you may say Ethiopia being black, brother. And Ethiopia was the name given to Africa long before the white man came there.
You're wrong. White man had come there. And the black man called himself Ethiopia, and he didn't say, I'm black. Ethiopia does not mean black. Ethiopia means exactly what the word indicates in its sound. Ethi from ethics. Opia from vision. Ethical vision. That's the meaning of Ethiopia, ethical vision. And if you study the history, you will find that the Africans of that part of the continent, they had ethics when the white man was a barbarian. This is the fact of history. They had high ethics, dignified, decent principles when the white man was a barbarian. I believe one of the worst developments for us is this motherland identity conflict. We just recently got to the place where we could say we are African Americans. Before my father, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Marcus Garvey introduced that term. He called us African Americans, and they broke it down finally to Afro-American. Why shorten it? No need to shorten it. Afro-African is not any longer than Spanish, Irish, Italian. Those are long names. The Italian won't call himself it American. He's Italian American. So why should we call ourselves Afro-American? Because the whole word was too much for us. The white man had made our minds closed against identity with Africa. And even though Marcus Garvey struggled and worked hard to establish black dignity, the acceptance of black and black dignity, our people still wasn't ready for the whole word. So they cut it down to Afro-America. The Irish is Irish-American. Italian is Italian-American. They don't cut it short. Spanish is Spanish-American. Jew is Jew-American. Jewish American. In fact, the Jew, for some reason or another, he doesn't identify himself as an American. He simply says he's Jew.
I don't know why he never accepted America. Maybe it was because America had accepted him, and he felt he didn't have to accept America. I don't know what it was, but that's a peculiar situation. Dear beloved people, looking back at that continent and seeing what happened to it, and then looking here in America and seeing what happened to the children of that continent that was brought here. We didn't come here, we were brought here. And that's a part of the history in the past that we should never forget. A lot of us want to forget that. We want to think that we've always been American. You haven't always been American. And as soon as your child learns how to understand English, you should start telling your young babies, say, look, you haven't always been on this continent. Now let me tell you how we got here. That's what intelligent people do. They preserve their past no matter how hard it is to bear. Because they know if they ever get cut off from it, they won't have any future over there. Be lost, totally lost. Now, people, Africa was a big continent there with many people living on it. It was not the black continent. Now, I'm using racist terminology. They called black Africa the black continent, meaning that it was undeveloped, superstitious, backwards. I'm telling you, and history bears witness, that Africa was not a black continent when the white man went there. When the white man went to Africa, he found scientists among your black ancestors. He found the highest development of psychology on earth. He found it in your continent, the continent of your mothers and fathers. These are the facts. Now, you've heard a lot of blacks come up and talk to you about your past and lie to you, exaggerated the history, exaggerated your role in the earth and in civilization. I'm telling you nothing with an exaggeration. Everything I'm telling you is nothing but the plain, simple truth. Unexaggerated, not exaggerated. No exaggeration. Black people had gotten into the sciences. They had developed psychology to such a high level that the psychology we have today no more superior than what they had yesterday in Africa. Now, that is not to say that there was not the superstitious man. Certainly he was there. The primitive man, he was there. The undeveloped man, he was there. But you couldn't say that Africa was a black continent as such, because Africa had known development that Europe had not known. You say, well, mister, what are you talking about, Egypt? No, I'm not only talking about Egypt. Sudan, under Egypt, Ghana, and many other places of Africa had experienced enlightenment before the white man experienced enlightenment. This is history. This is history. Now, the white man, when he woke up, when he became enlightened, turned on to the sciences, it enraged him. It enraged him that knowledge has sprung up in the black people and had dignified them
and hadn't come to him. You know, a newly enlightened person in the sciences is like a small child. And a small child is subject to be victimized by his own emotions. Say, oh mama, how come you gave him two pieces of bread and me only one? And that might disturb that child for the whole day. He might go to bed with that on his mind. First thing he wanted to do was conquer everybody else. First thing he wanted to do was punish everybody else who had knowledge before him. So he went out like a wild beast, making war on the cultural nations of the world. This is history. And he wasn't satisfied until he uprooted that culture, subdued them, and uprooted that culture. Do you know? No. No, we have to watch the time. Do you know Egypt has been dominated by foreign powers for 1900 years? That's a long time. It was just in 52 or 53 that Egypt got its independence. 1952 or 53, somewhere around there, that Egypt got its independence. Egypt was dominated by foreign powers, European powers, Mediterranean powers, and European powers for 19 centuries, 1900 years. And when the white man came to Africa, what was his thirst? What was his appetite? The knowledge that he found in Egypt. Right. Oh, he became incensed. He became, I can't think of the word. Good and mad. With the appetite to eat up the knowledge that was on that continent. History tells us that Napoleon, the conqueror, he wasn't a scholar as such. Napoleon was a warrior. But Napoleon, when he went to Africa with his soldiers, he also took a big contingent of scholars. This is history. And history also tells us that he turned his cannon on the Sphinx.
That's right.
Say, is this Imam Wazidin Muhammad? This is he. Same one, I haven't changed a bit. Don't intend to. I love truth. All right. Now, he turned his cannons on the Sphinx. Why would he blast the Sphinx with cannon fire, with cannonballs? Jealousy? If that was a white man's image, do you think he would have fired a cannon at it? The Sphinx couldn't hit him back. It was just gonna stand there. And the Sphinx wasn't the achievement
of that century's African. It was an achievement of the Africans he found there. That was the achievement of Africans who had been there about 3,000 and some centuries before he came there. Long, long time ago. But he saw in the image of the saints, the black man. That's why the Chicago Defender still has the Sphinx on his page, on his front page. Look at the Chicago Defender and you'll see the symbol there. It's the Sphinx on the front page of the Chicago Defender. To identify with the black. I have been to Egypt and I have looked at the Sphinx from several directions. The Sphinx is Nubian man. Not only do I know he's black, I know the race. The Sphinx is a Nubian man. Nubian. And let me tell you, the Nubians, most of them are the color of these shoes. And I'm not exaggerating. Their color is that color. Most Nubians. Black, very black. Smooth black skin. Smooth black skin. They have round faces, round oval-shaped faces, round faces, more round than long. That's the Nubians. If you look at the what appears to be the Egyptian headpiece, think about it, it's not a headpiece at all. It's that African's hair. His hair was like that. And the average one of us, when you comb our hair down, it looks just like that. All right? So why did Napoleon fire his cannon at the Sphinx? He wanted to destroy the sign of the black man's glory because he envied it. He was a conquering in the spirit of white supremacy, conquering in the spirit of desire for white domination. So he envied, he resented the presence of that sign of a black man that he had accomplished that great history, that great past that was on Africa, on the African continent. He wanted to get rid of it. Now, I didn't invite any white people here, but if you're here, you are blessed too today. Believe me, the white man needs to get his mind straight too. These lies of the history of the races have given the white man an artificial mind and has given us an artificial mind. Everybody that bought the lies has an unnatural or artificial mind. He thinks he's something that he's not, and you think you something that you're not. We're going to get it together. Oh, yes, we got to get it together. And believe me, today we can get it together. You hear what I said? Today, we can get it together. It's interesting how different terms for the same thing were given to the motherland and to the African man here in America. Now, they say Negro means black. And when you look up Negro, it does. It's a Spanish word, means black. Back in Spanish and Italian and Spanish, Negro means black. Negro means black. Negro. Now, we were told over here that we were Negroes. And I think that's why most of us got rid of that name Negro, because we know we didn't name ourselves that. We didn't give ourselves the name Negro.
And at the same time, we were told or taught or influenced to identify the people on the mother continent as black. We didn't call them Negroes. We called ourselves Negroes, and we called them black Africans. Now, we're talking about developments in our past that we have to go back and think about and deal with. And if they have knotted up our senses, we're going to have to solve the problem. Okay. Now, if you can recall, and I'm sure some of you can, you look like you're as old as I am, and I'm approaching 50. In fact, I'm going to tell you, if you could look down on my head, I went to a meat market, you know, and the man said, have a seat. He said, have a seat. So I sat down. And when he sat down, he looked, he said, oh, he said, the top of your head tells your age. Because when he looked down at the top of my head, he saw all that hair missing up there. So he said, the top of your head tells your age. So I said, yes, it's thinned out quite a bit. Now, anyway, getting back to this question about Africa now. If the African man was identified by us as black African, what effect did it have on us? It had a way of getting us to reject the African man. We have to admit that it was the only reason in the history of our history in America that we accepted the term black. Martha Garvey, he made a great effort, but he didn't succeed. Only a few people were calling themselves black. Nobuju Ali, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the term was popularized. And I think perhaps the one who did it was James Brown. You see, when you got a visceral nature, all the common sense teaching is just like pouring water on the duck's back. But if somebody can come along and do the boogie and communicate that through the boogie, the visceral dominated will hear the message. So James Brown with his, you know, he worked us up, man. He worked us up, and we heard him. Black and brown, say it loud. Black and brown. They have to lie, we got it. Say it loud. We got into it. They're black and brown. Yeah, we got into it. Getting back to that problem. We were not accepting black. And the white man had conditioned us to not accept black, to hate black and hate to be called black. I'm not talking about all white people. I'm talking about those who masterminded racism. Okay, so we would sit and look at the movies. I recall the days when I've looked at the movies, saw an African scene where Tarzan or some other white man was handling a black army of thousands single-handedly. And the black children in the audience at the movie were cheering
the white man on. Cheered him as he was beating up and shredding up and tearing up the blacks of Africa. Cheered him on. And I've heard youngsters come out of the movie laughing and making mockery of the Africans that they saw in the movie. Because the white man, he made it a point to present the Africans in the movie an ugly, distasteful image. Silly, typical, culturally deprived, totally neglected Negro. That's what they would show us on the screen. And I had to grow up and get grown almost before I learned that most of those Africans we were looking at were from Harlem. They picked them up from Harlem, carried them to Hollywood. So now we are addressing a scheme, a plan, to divide the black man of the earth. Call one black so that he won't be accepted by the one that he's going to call Negro. The one that he calls Negro, he's going to make him think that he ain't all black. That he is mulatto and brown and yellow and different colors, you see. And going to finally call all of them colored folks. So even the blackest one among them won't be conscious of his blackness. Say, what's your, hey, will you put your race on here? You forgot to put your race on. He put it colored. Colored. You remember the Tribune? In the one ads, the employment ads? Colored. White. Colored. White. So we were conditioned to accept those terms. Colored man. White man. While at the same time calling ourselves Negro too. But you know, with education, the white man, he pre-anticipated us. Like he always does. He said, look, you know, George, we got these niggas reading the Bible now. And you know, the Bible's going to make them understand language.
And accused somebody of twisting the eye and misrepresenting the religion while they're not able to defend themselves, and secondly, Congressman Spelter, that we facilitate these kinds of meetings should not allow this, and thirdly, Congressman Spelter, we should not include that to encourage that kind of communication.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Sister.
Many of the ideas that they brought were very much in general the same. And I think if we go to those points and all of us together come up with some constructive idea of what the role of imam and teachers are together, not the imam going on by themselves and coming up with something and presenting it to us. Because what they brought was a togetherness, and if we work together, I think.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Yes, brother.
Yes, sir. I think that this idea of having something specific for the imams is very necessary and essential. One, we have to understand that the imams are having problems too, because we really don't know how to define our role as it relates to education. So, therefore, we need specific. The next thing other than that, we know that education is our number one priority, but it's not the only thing. Therefore, the imam has to have something to keep him in balance because he has other things to do besides the school. And in order to keep this in balance, and in order to adequately educate this community, that everything in the community points forward.